the Plutarch Podcast. I'm your host, Tom Cox from Grammaticus.co. And today, in our 27th episode, we meet the Greek who lived through it all. All of the 4th century, that is. Phocion was 3 years old when Socrates died in 399. And then he lived through the rise and the reigns of Philip, Alexander, and finally dies under Cassander's takeover of Athens. This Greek could easily have fit into last season because he was alive as a young man for the lives of Agesilaus and Pelopidas. But really, he comes into his own after their deaths, and he gives us a great Greek perspective. We got a back-to-back Greek perspective here from Eumenes last month and Phocion this month on the Macedonian handling of the Greek problem. And it's a Greek problem that we know persists. They are angry with Philip. They try to stop Philip under Demosthenes. That doesn't work. They then revolt after being defeated by Philip. They then revolt when Philip dies. They then are defeated by Alexander. They then revolt when Alexander dies. Phocion is going to be our main eyewitness to these events. And it's really cool because even though you've never heard of him, Plutarch picked him on purpose as a virtuous example in broken times. So if you think that the times in which you are living are difficult, don't worry. Phocion is right there with you, and he lived in a broken time. But before we dive in, I want to thank you again for the support of your listening ears and the download. Be sure to tell your friends about the podcast you've particularly enjoyed or learned a lot from. Any feedback that would make it better, please send to tom@grammaticus.co. As always, I hope that these are encouraging you to continue your journey through Plutarch and helping you see and remember more along the way. If you are enjoying these podcasts, the best way to let me know is to leave me a rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts. As of the summer, I had about 60, but I'd like to get over 100 before Christmas. Thanks, guys. So, on to the man, the myth that you've never heard of. Phocion, spelled P-H-O-C-I-O-N. His parallel is another favorite of mine. You have heard of him, Cato the Younger. Really famous. I'm really stoked that we're so close to the Romans now that I can smell them. And there are a lot of Roman lives I'm going to enjoy doing. Cato will definitely be one of them. But let's stay focused on Phocion. Oh, nice pun. His fortune was not the same as his virtue. That was the point I had started making before I interrupted to tell you to give me the old five-star kishwow. What does that mean? He was at the helm of a shipwrecked state. Athens lost and continued optimistically to deny that they had ever lost or that they were losers. This is interesting. We're going to see an Athenian disconnect between the reality of the Macedonian military might, triple M, trademark, and the Athenian lack thereof, their inability to get their navy and army, and really even their population, up to a level where they can resist Macedon permanently. They're not doing the math. However, even though Phocion's virtue was overshadowed by Greece's obscurity under the Macedonian shadow, the reason Plutarch wants us to look at his life is to show us that virtue is still worth pursuing even in difficult times. So fortune, when it conflicts with good men, Plutarch thinks, oh, then we pass over all the good men that lived during difficult times. But if we really look closely at their lives, we learn to admire their virtues anyway, in spite of the difficult times in which they lived. This is one way that we know that Plutarch is not a consequentialist. He's not just saying, oh, it worked out well for them, therefore, they should be virtuous. Nor is he a Stoic that says, oh, it was terrible for them the whole time and they just grinned and bore it. Therefore, virtue is totally worth it. As is typical of his hero, Aristotle, he finds the mean between the extremes and he wants us to see virtue is worth pursuing and has rewards even when they don't redound into the political sphere. Even when our polis or our state does not seem to reap the benefits of our virtue, in large part because they keep rejecting what Phocion offers. So this is, life is organized in an interesting way. There's a Philip section, there's an Alexander section, and then there's a post-Alexander section. Those are kind of the three ways we are going to break it down after we talk about the person and the man. But throughout this life, we should keep in mind that Phocion was like a pithy, witty guy who managed to say a lot in a little. And so because he could say a lot in a little, it also feels like a quotation book of his most famous zingers or one-liners. And for that reason, I think it's kind of fun to read. But those are strewn throughout. So I will be giving his one-liners and occasionally sharing those. But he is known for his zingers, but they're zingers that sting. I guess that is what we mean by zinger when we say it, right? And when Athens is struggling, right, speaking the truth actually gets harder to someone in a sore place, someone in difficulties. The last thing you want to say, as we know in English, is I told you so, even if you did. And that's exactly why they're in their difficulties, right? The way Plutarch puts it is, true words can sting in a sore plight. But the reverse of this is that if you tell your friend always exactly what he wants to hear, or exactly what would just make him feel good, you're stuck ruining him as well. And it's no different for the politician. So we'll see that Phocion is elected general more often than any other Athenian, in part because he lives for a really long time, but also in part because the Athenians trusted him. But he is not the politician who will tell them what they want to hear. Normally, the political lesson that we want to draw here for ourselves is that you have to find the mean between the popular and the healthy choice and kind of offer what's best. So whenever you see Phocion and you kind of disagree with his decision, this is it's good to remember how Plutarch starts the life and think, oh, he compromised with an evil people and that's why his decision doesn't feel as good, maybe. It's a thought that I will come back to. So this mixture between reasonableness and austerity, if a politician can pull it off, pays off in the long run with a virtuous citizenry sacrificing for the common good. But it is difficult. I mean, it's so difficult that we're not even looking back at Pericles and thinking, wow, that's exactly what Pericles did. He was reasonable and austere. No, if you remember, in that life, a lot of what Pericles did is beat his political opponent Cimon by outspending him, by using government money to outspend him and give people, pay people for rowing and pay people for jury duty and pay people for all these things in order to earn their votes. Anyway, but Plutarch also has a theological reason behind this philosophical rule, is that reasonableness and austerity doesn't just pay off in the long run with virtuous citizenship, but it's actually the way God rules the universe, through persuasion and reason. Oh, there's that another theme of season 4 that's been developing, right? Persuasion and reason is the opposite of tyranny. If you're using persuasion and reason, you're never forcing someone to do something. As such, the greatest leaders in this season, and really for Plutarch period, because he just compared them to God, are those that leave you free and just persuade you with reason. So, he says that this is one of the tightest parallels he's ever written. So, Cato and Phocion are as close as they can possibly be. And so when he lists their virtues, you get a really cool rundown of some of the virtues that Plutarch thinks are the coolest. Their natures both had the same general shape and stamp, and even their virtues start to look similar. So they blended severity. Again, the Greek word austeron gives us the word austerity, right? So that comes straight from Greek. And kindness, or love of your fellow man, is the Greek there. They blended, so severity and kindness. They blended caution and bravery. They blended care for others with a fearfulness for themselves, and an eager pursuit of justice with a careful avoidance of baseness or shameful actions. that's a pretty cool list. And you think, man, yeah, somebody who could do all those things and serve the people would be pretty admirable. So let's check him out. Phocion was a student of Plato and also Xenocrates, who was also a student of Socrates, but one whose dialogues don't survive. So he learned at the feet of the philosophers. Like I said, he was three when Socrates died, so he would have been old enough to be a student of Plato because Plato was about 20-something, 30-something when Socrates died. So he learned a lot of these philosophical habits that we associate with the philosophical schools. Austerity. He would wear no outer cloak except in the most severe weather, and he generally walked around shoeless. He rarely laughed and was never seen to cry. His men, when he led them in battle, would joke that it must be a really cold night because Phocion was wearing a cloak over his regular clothes. They had all put cloaks on a long time ago. So how did he look physically? This is the point where Plutarch takes us to his physical description, and he's basically like, he kind of looked forbidding. Okay, kind of looked angry. One of those people. We know those people. Their resting face is their angry face. And you're like, are you okay? And they're like, I'm fine. Why? And you're like, no, never mind. Just kidding. Huh. He was kind underneath that. But his kindness is different to the polis than it is to a person. So he's aware that a political group can get carried away very quickly and seems to have its emotions, is much more easily stirred by its emotions than it is by reason. And so he's much kinder to individuals than we will see he is when in the assembly talking to the people. He's brief. He's to the point. Demosthenes respects him, saying that while the common opinion was that while Demosthenes was the best orator, Phocion was the most fearsome, forbidding. Again, there's that like harsh edge to him. Okay. And just as the most valuable coin is the one that contains the most worth in the smallest coin, so too does his speech. Right? He can mean the most with the fewest words. As a matter of fact, Demosthenes calls him his pruning knife to his speeches. So Demosthenes can talk with the best of them, but his speeches go on and on and on. Phocion will very frequently say what he needs to say in a sentence. And that's if he needs a sentence, because Plutarch tells us a nod from a good man is more powerful than any number of elaborate sentences. And so there it is. Ethos, right? The character of the speaker always matters more than pathos or logos. You may be able to move their emotions, pathos, get them in a state where they want to listen to you. And you may have unassailable logic. But the thing that moves men most to follow your lead is who you are. What a great lesson. So who does he follow? He's a follower of a general we've not heard of called Chabrias. And this general already flies into extremes. And Phocion needs to balance him out. He balances his uneven and violent temper. And he gives an example of his unevenness and violentness, really his recklessness, another key virtue there for Aristotle, that is the excess of bravery, right? It's not bravery falls in between cowardliness and recklessness, and this guy, Chabrias, is reckless to the point that he throws away his life in Chios by forcing a landing too quickly when fighting a polis that had revolted against Athens. But he fights with him before his death, okay, at Naxos, when the Athenians regain control of the sea from the Spartans. So recall from the life of Lysander that Lysander breaks the back of the Athenian navy, really breaks the whole Athenian navy. There's only like 7 ships left by the end. It is 25 years from that, or really 30 years, in 376, when the Athenian navy finally is able to defeat the Spartans at sea convincingly enough to have their navy back as the number one in the Aegean. They're like, what? I thought Alexander... Yeah, I know. This is before Alexander or Philip has even come. So this is how young Phocion is, right? Or old, depending on which direction we're looking in. So 30 years after the end of the Peloponnesian War, and on an auspicious day, the day that they won the victory of the Eleusinian Mysteries, Plutarch loves to keep track of this day for important events. So it's like for Americans, right, saying that July 4th was both the day that the Declaration of Independence was signed, but it's also the day that Thomas Jefferson and John Adams died in the same year, right, years later. So that's a like doubly important day because they were two of the last living founders and two of the most important ones. So to connect them to July 4th is just so cool, right? That's what the Eleusinian Mysteries are for Plato. They're a really important cult. I mean, by cult, I mean of worship, right? Like in the old sense of culture. That helps define the Athenians as who they are. The Eleusinian Mysteries have shown up in like the life of Alcibiades, the life of Dion, the life of Pericles. This is a very important day for the Athenians to keep track of the good things that happen on it. So Phocion is also getting back to the thread of what is his rise to power, his rise to the Athenians trusting him. He's serving under this general. He serves on the left wing. He is there and is partly responsible for the Athenians regaining sea power, but he's also somebody that the allies like to interact with. He's somebody that the allies trust. I think the last time we saw this was the life of Aristides, where Aristides was allowed to set the amounts that the islands had to pay, and everybody was still at the time so grateful to Athens for freeing them from Persian threats, and Aristides was himself so just and incorruptible that everyone just accepted the numbers that he chose. And they only started to be raised by Cimon and Pericles later, who were, let's just say, less trusted. So when Chabrias dies, though, this is the reliability. He's reliable not only in collecting tribute and in being trusted by the allies, but Chabrias dies and Phocion tries to raise his son to be a good man. So he takes his son into his household. And here is where Plutarch hits on another theme that becomes a real problem in the last half of the 4th century. Phocion notices the widening gap between those who stand on the bima and speak. So the bima is the raised platform in the assembly. And those who lead in battle, the strategos, right? The guy who leads the stratia, the army. So if you have people who lead and people who speak, there's a real problem. Because he looked back to Pericles, Aristides, and Solon, and they were the ideal. They were a combination. They were men who could lead in battle and speak before the assembly. And at least from Phocion's reckoning, so could Athena. She was the warrior who wielded wisdom as well. Pretty cool. That's the ideal for Phocion. His main goal for the Athenian people is to promote peace. So notice that this is a different goal than somebody like Pericles, which was to grow the empire, right? To grow and then ultimately to maintain the empire. Different goal than somebody like Alcibiades, who wanted to double the size of the empire overnight. So his goal is peace. And he held the office of general 45 times without ever having to canvass for votes. There's going to be a strong parallel with Cato there. People trust Phocion. But he also opposed the Athenian people to their face more often than anyone else. There was a time, this is just a funny story that he tells right here. The Oracle at Delphi says that all the Athenians agree except one man. And Phocion just raises his hand and is like, yeah, I'm that guy. It's me. And then at another time, it seemed like everybody was agreeing with him. And he immediately stepped back and thought to himself, oh man, I could really be wrong then, because everybody agreed with him. So, curmudgeons are useful. We should keep them around. Then we have a list of a few quips. I'll just share a few. Okay. Once, when asked to contribute to a public sacrifice, he says he can only do so after he has first paid his own personal debts. So he wants to make sure he owes no man any money. And then he will pay for public services. At another point where he cannot seem to convince the Athenians not to go to war, this time against the Boeotians, He says, you may vote to force me to do something against my will, that is, to lead you in battle, but you can never force me to speak against my judgment. Bam. So he would still listen to the laws, as a parallel with Socrates, but he was always going to tell them exactly what he thought while doing so. In the midst of all of these anecdotes, Phocion comes off looking harsh, and Plutarch even admits that, where he says, it's difficult for me to see in all these instances, how Phocion earned the nickname The Good. But I think if we look etymologically at this word, the good, ho Christos, is what is used, the good, it is not, if you know Greek, a word like agathos or kalos, which are words to describe nobility or generic moral goodness. This is Christos. It really has at its root either the verb kraomai, to use, or the verb kre, to be necessary. And so it's much more like a utility or a necessity, and it comes to be translated as honesty or dependability when used as a noun. So it's really a goodness that's deeper than his skin. It's not a goodness of presentation. It's not gentlemanliness, we might say, where you can make the right choice and put everyone at ease at the same time. But for Plutarch, gentlemanliness is not a necessary virtue. If people are still going to trust you, the way you present yourself should be Christos before it should be kalos. Right? The beauty of how you present your words, or the focusing on the how rather than the what, to say it another way, don't matter as much. And then he compares him to wine, where he says, well, maybe it's like wine that can be both pleasant and intense at the same time, or sweet and austere. Ooh, there's that word again. Austere, it's like the key word for Phocion. And then we get examples. Okay, sure, he could be harsh, he could be obstinate, but he actually always showed himself humane and accessible to all, to the point that he even helped his enemies when they fell into distress. There was one time, enemies and strangers, right? One time he was helping a stranger who just, everybody knew he had the reputation of being a worthless man. And when his friends try to correct him on this, like, hey, he's probably going to be back in this situation soon, he said, well, the good don't need my help. Oh, that's right. That strikes me as Jesus saying that the sick are the ones that need the doctor. It's kind of cool. So now we're getting into the Philip section. That's him personally. That's his rise to power in Athens, why they trust him, why they see him as a hero. But it's important to realize that it isn't just the Athenians that trust him and see him as the good. It's the allies too. And so Euboea is one of the first allies that gets Phocion specifically, and then the Athenians by extension, involved in this fight against Philip. And Euboea, the little island, well, it's a big island actually, on the northeastern border of Attica, wants to revolt from some tyrants that Philip had put in place around 350 BC. So we're halfway through the century now. But when Phocion arrives, he sees that it's a ridiculous situation. There's so much money changing hands and bribery. That's one of the things Philip was very good at. That the whole island's corrupt and he doesn't know who to trust or who he can bring to his side. So he makes the best of the men he just brought, right? He brought a small contingent hoping he'd be joined by allies, but oh well, he's got to do what he can. And then just picks the battle ground that will play to his advantage. So he ends up taking a strategic fort at the narrowest point of Euboea and releases the prisoners. So he's still able to accomplish what he sets out for, even as the situation changes before his very eyes. So then we skip 10 years in which Philip really rises to power, right? And by 340 BC, Philip is approaching the Hellespont. The person the Athenians send is just a speaker, not a doer, right? It's this Homeric balance, right? Be a doer of deeds and a speaker of words. Don't split that line in half. Keep that line together. But Chares is only a speaker of words. And the Athenian allies reject him. And when the Athens is angry to hear that their ambassador has been rejected, Phocion points out, don't be angry with those who didn't trust him, but with the man who caused the distrust. There's a witty witticism, a zinger. But when Phocion gets up there, he's actually able to be led into Byzantium because they trust him. And he's able to save it and push back Philip from taking the city, at least that time. Philip is more than willing to try again later. But he proved to the Athenians for the first time that Philip could be repulsed and even pushed back. And maybe for the last time. But then Megara asked for help again. They request Phocion because he's trustworthy. So they aren't just asking Athens. They're asking Phocion, and he goes and fortifies their port, gives them long walls. But again, if Philip can end a round, he doesn't have to attack Megara if he can conquer Athens, Thebes, and Corinth, which ultimately is what he does, right? So while Phocion was away with the Athenian allies in 340, the frayed relationship with Philip, you know, with Demosthenes leading the charge here, the Athenians chose generals to engage against Philip directly, and when Phocion gets back, he tries to change their minds, which just makes them angrier. Like, who are you? Demosthenes had convinced the Athenians to fight, and then they were trying to figure out where they could fight to have the battle be as far from Athens as possible. And Phocion tells them, why don't we focus on how to win instead of where to fight? But of course, the defeat, once the negotiations all break down, comes at Chaeronea in 338. And Phocion is not used in the battle as the general, but he is used in the aftermath as the ambassador.
I do want to take a brief pause right here in the show to let you know that season 4 of the Plutarch podcast is brought to you by the support of Hackett Publishing. This small independent publisher has been serving the humanities since 1972. With affordable translations in everything from Homer to Dante, they've generously offered listeners of this podcast 20% off any title in their catalog and free shipping in the US and Canada. With the coupon code Plutarch, you could add Stanley Lombardo's translation of the Iliad or the Odyssey to your library. You could get the complete works of Plato in a beautiful hardcover, or you could enjoy Shakespeare's Julius Caesar or Antony and Cleopatra. For the last 2 years, I've used Jan Blitz's notes on Julius Caesar to prepare my own students for the Roman context and background on Shakespeare's masterpiece. Really, that play is worth getting just for the introductory matter and the notes. Just go to hackettpublishing.com today and enter the coupon code Plutarch for 20% off and free shipping. I'll put the link in the show notes as well. But for now, we'll go back to the show.
So Philip calls everybody to go to Corinth and he declares war against the Persians, right? But Phocion didn't know what he was going to say before they got there, so he was hesitant to send anybody to Corinth. And when the cities hear that the plan is to invade Persia, they think, great, we're going to take all of our war and all of our young men and export it somewhere else. Awesome, we can stop burning each other's cities down, right? But what sounded exciting at the beginning, they don't realize that Philip is now going to ask them to donate their own ships and their own men to send off to on a journey who knows how long and who knows how far away. Right. So when the rubber meets the road and they have to put skin in the game and other overused metaphors, Phocion stands up to remind them, without hackneyed metaphors, that their ancestors sometimes ruled and sometimes were ruled. Sometimes led and sometimes were led. But they managed to perform well in both places to save not only their own city, but all the Greeks. The best two examples of this are Aristides and Themistocles, both of whom managed to accomplish their ends even when the Spartans were in charge above them. It's great. I love those stories. But anyway, 2 years after Chaeronea, Philip is dead, and we're now in the Alexander section of Phocion's life. 336, Alexander's dead, and Phocion is trying to get people not to offer thank offerings for this man's death. And the way he puts it is pretty witty. He says, look, the army that defeated us by Chaeronea has only lost one man. Why are you celebrating? But as we know from the life of Demosthenes, he now sets his sights on Alexander, who's already marching down towards Thebes And Phocion asks, why provoke a man like this, who's reaching out for such great glory? And he adds to it, I wouldn't allow my own citizens to die, even if they wanted to. So it's a difference between certain death, which he doesn't want to send them into, and the risk of death for your own protection. Really, it's a virtuous balance of bravery, right? You have to risk your life, but really you're trying to save it. And recklessness, you're kind of throwing your life away. So Thebes is burned down in 335, and Alexander summons the 10 Athenian orators to his presence. And Phocion again recommends, just give them what they want, okay? But it is because of Phocion requesting things from Alexander that Alexander grants Demosthenes' life and a number of other things that allow the Athenians, well, not to suffer the fate of the Thebans. By the time Alexander is marching into Persia, he considers Phocion both his guest friend, his xenos, right, to use the loaded Greek term, as well as his personal friend, his philos. So Alexander would greet him after he had conquered Darius with a normal, let's call it a greeting between equals, chairein, joy, right? It's still the modern Greek word for hi, chaira. And so there's a way where Phocion is one of the few Greeks, very few Greeks, seen as an equal to Alexander, even after Alexander's head has maybe grown bigger, right? Most sources tell us that Alexander tries to give Phocion 100 talents. He rejects it several times. The men come to his house and see that his wife needs their own bread. Phocion draws water himself, washes his own feet. They tell him this is all shameful, and he has to accept the money from the king. And Phocion rejects it again and again and again. And Plutarch's conclusion is the man who rejects the sum is richer than he who offers it. Oh, nice. And he's worried about everything that comes with the money. He knows, like, people look at you differently when you're suddenly really wealthy just because of who your friends are. They talk down to you. They don't trust you as much. What I have is worth more than those 100 talents. But then Alexander complains. He's like, hey, Phocion, in order to be a friend, you have to accept gifts as well as give them. And you've rejected all my gifts. So Phocion says, all right, you can return some Greek prisoners who are currently imprisoned in Sardis. And Alexander says, yep, let's do it. So in 324, Alexander sends Craterus back with the Macedonian veterans. And Craterus tries, on behalf of Alexander, again, to give Phocion the revenues of one of the cities, okay, one city that Alexander has conquered. But this would be grotesque amounts of money. I mean, it could amount to hundreds of talents a year over his lifetime. I'd never heard of any of these cities, but you know, tax revenue adds up quickly. Phocion refuses again. And thankfully, he doesn't have much time to offend Alexander because Alexander's dead by the summer of the next year. But in Plutarch's own day, still, 400 years after the death of Phocion, his house is still a tourist attraction, pointed out to tourists walking through Athens to see how plain and simple it was. The only thing that they've added to it is bronze discs over the doorway to make it clear, like, this is Phocion's house, like a bronze plaque. You can almost see it. At this point, he turns and looks at his family because Alexander's dead. And so we need to look a little bit deeper into his character before we go into the post-Alexander aftermath. And the easiest way or a helpful way to see his character is going to be to look at his wife and son. One will be a bonus, right? One will be in the plus column and one will be in the negative column and might not make him look as good. So his wife, though, has the same virtues he does. She has a reputation for her prudence, her simplicity, and she is called an equal to Phocion, in honesty. And there's that word, there's that noun form of that word, Christos, which was used earlier to call him the good. But in one translation I read, it's called probity, and another it's called honesty. So the idea is Phocion and his wife are equally trustworthy, equally awesome, equally impressive to people to say, oh, Phocion's wife said that? Yeah, I'll believe it. That must be true. And so you think of the, this reminds me of Odysseus' line about nothing is better than this or more lasting when two people, a man and his wife, keep a harmonious household. He says that to Nausicaa in book six, but one hopes in the beauty of that line. He's thinking about Penelope, and it certainly is true of Phocion and his wife, who is not named in this life, partly because Plutarch was a pretty good researcher, and if he'd known, he would have been proud of knowing that, and he would have told us, so... that's Phocion's wife, famous for her virtue, or as famous for her virtue as her husband is, which is cool. His son, not so much. But Phocion doesn't know it at first. He tries to get his son to do vigorous exercise. He wants him to compete in the Panathenaic Festival in horse vaulting. I think horse riding, horse jumping. Not really sure. Jumping with a horse, maybe. Anyway. But he really wants him to do it, not because he wants him to get like addicted to horses or, you know, really into racing. He really wants him to get the bodily training he needs, because when he looks at his son, he's a little bit soft and a little bit irregular in his habits. And you're like, wow, 2,300 years ago, someone was saying that. It's a common dad thing. Like, you're soft, son. I want to make sure you're tough. But the Panathenaic festival thing kind of backfires, because Phocion's son goes to all the victory banquets and just like loves those more, and maybe will be motivated by the wrong things and party too much, right? Work hard, play hard, right? Sort of thing where you're like, you're a really talented athlete, but why do you drink so much after the games? So in order to counteract that, he enrolls him in the Spartan Agoge. See the Agoge episode for a description thereof. To make his son tougher, right? You can also see like Kyrgios and Agesilaus episodes. The Athenians are insulted by this. I mean, like, why is our way of living not good enough? Pericles has an entire funeral oration in Thucydides that contrasts the Spartan way of life with the Athenian one. And one of the primary focuses of Pericles is the freedom that the Athenians enjoy, but still allows them to be tough, to win in battle. So, anyway... they're offended. Again, Phocion doesn't really care. And then we have this last image of something that happens during Alexander's conquest of Persia that causes a lot of trouble for Athens, and specifically a lot of trouble for Demosthenes. So you can go back and listen to that life, but I'll tell this story here because Phocion's role in it is very different than Demosthenes's. So Alexander had a childhood friend called Harpalus. And Harpalus was exempted from military duty. He was not fit for military duty. But he seems to have followed along slowly in the wake of the army. So he's in Asia Minor when Alexander asks for more books in the center of Persia. And so he's able to send those ahead, right? So Harpalus, though, is given more and more opportunities and controls and positions of power until it seems to totally corrupt him. And he runs away from Asia Minor, where he'd been given control of several cities, with 700 talents. Okay, that's a ton of money. We're talking millions and millions of dollars just disappeared. He apparently arrives in Athens ready to spend it, ready to like live his life and retire in Athens, because I guess Asia Minor wasn't Greek enough or wasn't cool enough. So Athens is where it's at. But he's got to pay off all these orators who, you know, run the legal system here. And he offers Phocion 700 talents. And Phocion just tells him, man, you are so going to regret trying to corrupt the city like this. Even though everybody else is fawning all over Harpalus because this dude just arrived with a sweet entourage and lots of money, 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 cash money. So The cash money is a real problem, not for Phocion, but it throws into the shade every single orator who may accept money from Harpalus. So even when Demosthenes brings a suit against Harpalus to say, like, hey, he's corrupting the city, Demosthenes falls into suspicion that he himself has accepted money and maybe this is his way of hiding it. And you're like, oh man, right? This is the litigious Athenians at work again. But there is a way that Harpalus does manage to hurt Phocion in a way he doesn't even manage to hurt Demosthenes as he hurt his reputation. Because Harpalus' son-in-law, Charicles, not Heracles, but Charicles, grows close to Harpalus, probably one of the hangers-on who's like, yay, free money, right? Harpalus has a couple famous scenes before he has to leave Athens because he makes himself persona non grata very quickly. But he builds, so his favorite courtesan dies, and he puts Charicles, Phocion's son, in charge of building this expensive tomb in her memory, which in Plutarch's day was still visible on the road from Athens to Eleusis. And he supposedly spent 30 talents on this tomb. But at that point, right, as he's mourning the loss of his concubine, Antipater demands that Harpalus be surrendered to the Athenian people. So he runs away to Crete, where he's assassinated. The problem now is that he leaves an orphan daughter, and Phocion takes her into his house after he's dead and tries to raise this child. It's rough, right? When Charicles is brought to trial, right, is caught up in all these trials about accepting money from Harpalus, Phocion refuses to help him. He's like, look, you were the one that got close to him. I only wanted you as a son-in-law for just purposes, he said. But shortly after that, Alexander dies, and that changes the subject again. So Phocion tries to persuade the Athenians at this point against revolution with the rather pithy advice, he'll still be dead tomorrow. Calm down, everyone. But of course, no one comes down, and everyone immediately wants to beat Antipater, who is the Macedonian, with Craterus, who is going to come down as regent, right? And probably, well, Antipater does eventually serve as regent after Perdiccas dies. So Leosthenes takes everything, gathers everything Athens has, all their ships, all their men, and he's like, we need to roll the dice on this one war. Plutarch does not approve. He uses terms like Leosthenes dragged the city into the Lamian War. But Leosthenes is convinced, we can do this, guys. And Phocion calls his speeches towering cypress trees, which bear no fruit, no edible fruit, anyway. And another speaker asks him, hey, when are you going to tell the Athenians to go to war? Like, when is it that you're actually going to stand by and advise us to fight instead of being this peaceful general? And he said, easy. When young men hold their ranks, when the rich pay their share, and when the orators, the speakers, keep their hands out of the public money. Kind of like a 12th of never, that feels like to me, but he is looking for when we are a virtuous citizenry, right? When we can actually all fight for the common good, when the young men are going to stay in the army because they care about fighting for Athens, when the wealthy are going to separate themselves from their money because they care more about Athens than their money, and when the orators are going to speak to the good of Athens instead of just trying to get more money. Man, Athens was corrupt. He did admit that Leosthenes had made good preparations, but for a sprint, not a marathon. Because it was, after all the ships, men, and money that Athens had. Quite a gamble. Leosthenes wins some battles at first. He drives Antipater's forces into Lamia. Phocion still claims that he's right. And shortly thereafter, Leosthenes is killed, and a Macedonian garrison is once again installed in Athens. The Athenians try to field an army at this point, and Phocion, as a means of like reminding them that they have no army really to fight with, says, "All right, everybody under 60, grab provisions for 5 days and let's march out right now." And they're all like, "Whoa, whoa, wait, what?" And he's like, "Wait, I'm 80. So I'll take all the young men with me." Oh, dang. Right? It's also clear that he's 80 right now. Okay. Antipater is alive. He has seen Philip and Alexander. Whew, man, this guy is really getting there. So he does prevent one Macedonian naval captain from landing in Attica. He actually routs his soldiers and kills the Macedonian leader, fighting this battle, by the way, at 80 years old. So, fun fact. But then the Greeks are ultimately defeated at the Battle of Crannon in 322. And Antipater offers generous peace terms that dissolve any allies the Athenians had before the battle. So, Phocion has to tell them when they come to him for help, "I told you so." Or at least he can't help himself from saying, "If you'd believed me before, we wouldn't be in this position." But they choose him as one of the ambassadors and they send him off to Antipater, who's camped in the fortified position at Thebes in the Cadmea, really a few days' march away from Athens. Phocion offers the Macedonians, he said, "Let's settle peace terms here, and so you remain in Thebes and we'll figure it out. That is, with an army right at our gates, we will be much more disadvantaged." Craterus says, "Heck no," but Antipater grants it as a favor to Phocion. So this is the third Macedonian leader that just has respect for Phocion's virtue, and it really does play to Athens' advantage, though no one seems to know or care at the time, notice or care at the time. There is somebody that Antipater hates, though, and it is the philosopher Xenocrates, friend of Plato, student of Socrates, still alive at this time. Plato had died, remember? So Xenocrates, though, has a reputation not just for virtue, but for being able to encourage or inspire virtue in those around him. But Antipater, again, one of those officers corrupted in the wake of Alexander's conquests, seems immune even to Xenocrates' inspiration. He does not allow Xenocrates to speak. He completely ignores him. He interrupts him and shuts him down. We're going to see this playbook repeated. And we should remember that Craterus is right there watching as this happens. This is the Craterus who was killed by Eumenes in the last life. Here are Antipater's terms. "Give up Demosthenes and Hyperides and go back to requiring property ownership for your democracy and accept a Macedonian garrison, permanent garrison in the Piraeus, which is your port, not your main city. On top of all this, we'll also fine you to cover the costs that Macedon incurred in the war." The ambassadors accept. Phocion does request, as a personal favor, that there be no garrison. But Antipater says, "Look, I can only give you what's not going to ruin me. Sorry. We'll go with the garrison." So again, we get the destruction of the Athenian democracy, the only ancient democracy that was based only on citizenship and whose voting rights were not tied to property. He says, "Tie them back to property." The garrison arrives, led by a friend of Phocion's, and guess what? It also arrives on the inauspicious day during the Eleusinian Mysteries. That same day that they had recovered sea power. This is interesting because Plutarch now has to reflect on, what do the gods think of Athens? It seems like in Themistocles' time, they were on the side of Athens. They had been willing to help. Now they seem to be indifferent to whatever sorrows Athens suffered under. Strange. There's other omens. One is really weird and has to do with Demeter. Somebody's washing a pig for her to sacrifice to her during the Eleusinian Mysteries, and a shark apparently comes up into the warm, shallow waters and eats the man from the waist down. I mean, if you know anything about sharks, that does actually sound really doable. But what a weird omen. And Plutarch interprets the omen for us and tells us, oh, of course. That means that the Athenians are going to lose the lower part of their city. That is the Piraeus and the long walls. Kind of look like legs, you know? But the garrison doesn't harm the inhabitants. Okay, they come in, they roll in, they pick their fortified position on top of the Munichia, which is the mountain that overlooks the Piraeus and is sacred to Artemis. But 12,000 citizens lose the vote because they don't own property. And some of these just leave the city to go settle elsewhere. I mean, if you've lost your citizen rights, you can't vote, you can't be in the assembly, you can't be in a jury, you can't fill any office, general, etc. So it's a big loss. Demosthenes dies, as we see in his life. Hyperides also dies. And the Athenians now kind of want Philip and Alexander back. They're wishing that they had other kings in charge whom they hated at the time. Because as difficult as Philip and Alexander were, or as wily, or as conniving, or as powerful, Plutarch comes out and calls Antipater a tyrant, living under the guise of a common man in a simple mode of life. The leader of Antipater's garrison offers Phocion money, third time now that he's been offered money. And he says, oh, I certainly don't need it now. And they ask him to take it for his son. And he says, well, if he lives simply, then he already has enough. But as he behaves now, nothing will be sufficient. And then Plutarch tells us Antipater asked him to do something unfitting. Something so strange that it was not even worth recording in writing, or Plutarch himself didn't know. But Phocion has to respond, look, I can't be both your friend and your flatterer. So until the end of his days, he lives in noble poverty. That is kind of cool because it's not a common theme for Plutarch to call poverty noble in and of itself. But it is a very limited way of how do you know you have enough? You have enough either when you decide that it's enough or when you've given yourself everything your appetites want. Oh, wait, your appetites are infinite. Right, so you got to go with the first one. So he's able to negotiate with Antipater to keep the peace. They get generous terms on their repayment of that fine. But the problem is Antipater is not going to live forever. And he dies in 319. So Antipater does a weird thing and he leaves the power to Polyperchon, or Polysperchon. I mentioned him as well in the life of Eumenes. But Antipater had a son to whom he did not give the throne. Odd. So now you have Cassander and Polyperchon taking sides. And the first battlefield that they are going to fight it out in is Greece. As a matter of fact, it's more specific than that. It's Athens. So Polyperchon, though, is, remember, the rightful regent, the representative of the potential future kings, either Philip Aridaeus, who again wasn't all there in the head, or Roxana, or Alexander IV, who's still about 4 years old. So we're really only about 4 years out from the death of Alexander the Great. Awesome. Now the Athenians have to take sides in the Macedonian settlement. Who do they side with, Cassander or Polyperchon? Well, Polyperchon is the one that inherited everything from Antipater, so Phocion takes Polyperchon's side. Okay. But Cassander is going to wheel and deal as best he can to get control of as many of the Macedonian garrisons as he can. So he finally ends up getting control of the Athenian garrison, and when he does, he just replaces its head. And strangely, Phocion is now in a position he's never been in before. No Macedonian leader likes him. Cassander doesn't like him, and Polyperchon doesn't like him. or trust him, which is weird. They might also not know him. So even though he sides with Polly Perkin, they both seem to collude in Phocion's end. So Polly Perkin ignores or interrupts Phocion every time he speaks. He treats him the way Antipater had treated Xenocrates. And we should see the end coming with this, right? He places a guard around Phocion, and he sends Phocion back to Athens for a trial. Trial should be in air quotes. They're publicly dragged through the Ceramicus district, the public district right by the Agora, and they're brought to the theater carved below the cliff of the Acropolis. And the theater is packed, not just with citizens, but with everybody, slaves, foreigners, men, women, right? All of these people who really would not be on a jury. And so already Plutarch's giving us the image, this is not a jury trial. Then a letter is read from Polyperchon, is read aloud to say that he had already judged these men to be traitors, but the citizens should give the sentence for this crime. So he does mention specifically the citizens, at which point most of the citizens start to weep, or at least the best ones, says Plutarch. And one citizen even stands up and says, hey, since the king entrusted this decision to the citizens, then why don't the slaves and foreigners leave? I have a question about this. I don't know why this citizen doesn't mention having the women leave. I don't know. Were the women allowed to watch the political spectacle go on? Or does Plutarch just think it's assumed that if you mention slaves and foreigners leaving, then obviously the women would leave too? I don't know. But anyway, it's definitely a political circus, political theater. Those gathered don't obey, right? They outnumber the citizens, and they realize what this is. They're already calling out, actually, for them to be stoned. Phocion asks, do you wish to put us to death justly or unjustly? And when they all shout justly, he says, well, then you have to hear me. They still refuse to listen, but he steps closer and basically yells at them, I admit my guilt and choose death as its penalty. But the men who are with me are not guilty, so why put them to death? He asks as a rhetorical question. Oops. Because then they answer it and they say, we put them to get death because they're your friends. So the verdict is read aloud, and instead of even raising their hands, again, it would be a sign of democracy, a sign that things were right in Athens, but remember, we're in a shipwrecked state, and they're willing to put a virtuous man to death. The entire theater, instead of raising their hands, jumps to its feet to shout the approval of this proposal for death for Phocion and four of his friends. Three others are condemned to death in absentia, which basically means don't come back to Athens or we'll kill you. So many men are weeping. Phocion's face looks as it always did when he left the assembly. Remember, this man doesn't cry. People are pretty amazed at his calmness and his megaloptsuchia, his grandness of soul, his great-souledness. His enemies, though, continue to taunt him, spit in his face. And they ask him, what do you want us to tell your son? As in, you're not even going to see him before you die. And he says, don't resent the Athenians for this. So they take him to the prison where the executioner prepares the hemlock, which now, for going on 75 years, has been the execution of choice, almost 100 years, has been the execution of choice for the Athenian people. Some poison. I don't know if it kills you painfully or painlessly, but it seemed to kill Socrates painlessly. It's also what killed Socrates in 399 when Phocion was 3. But the drug runs out. The executioner didn't make enough to kill 5 men. And so he demands to be paid before he goes and makes another mixture. Phocion asks, why do I have to pay for the privilege of execution? But anyway, he has one of his friends go and get the money. And he pays the executioner because, after all, the laborer deserves his wages. They execute him on a festival day, which is another sacrilege, right? Almost as inauspicious as executing him on the day of the Eleusinian Mysteries. And he's carried beyond the limits of Attica and not even given burial in Athens. He's rejected by Athens even in his death. He's burned by fires, from Megara, the western neighbor of Athens. His wife erects a cenotaph. That comes from Greek, and it means an empty tomb, right? Or a memorial plaque, essentially. On the spot where he was burned, and she pours libations there. Eventually, she brings his bones back to the house and buries them by his hearth, hoping they would one day be restored to a grave that they belonged in. And eventually, the Athenians do come to their senses, realizing what an example he had been of justice and moderation. And so they build a bronze statue in his honor and give him a public burial. It's interesting, they did that the same thing for Demosthenes, right? Years later, they respect him and they build a statue for him. Years later, they respect Phocion and build a statue for him. But you're almost like too little too late, guys. Although it is good that he can still be a hero we can read about and learn from. Phocion's son, unfortunately, did not turn out very well. But just so that we don't leave on that image, Plutarch tells us that Phocion's fate reminded all of the Greeks, most closely, of the fate of Socrates, that the sin and misfortune of Athens were the same in both instances. And so, looking back at this man's life, we see really the whole 4th century unfold for the Greeks before the successors of Alexander have really settled who's going to be in charge of Macedon. We will get to that in the life of Demetrius, who is next. But for now, let's look at some key vices and virtues. You're now starting to hear the regular ones, okay? The 4 cardinal virtues, or what will come to be called the 4 cardinal virtues later, in large part are the tradition handed down from Plato and Aristotle to Plutarch. He's constantly referring to prudence, justice, fortitude, and temperance. Fortitude could also be called bravery, andreos, right? And temperance is moderation, sophrosune, and justice, dikaiosune, has motivated almost every single one of Plutarch's heroes. But there's a couple virtues here that we have not seen in very many people. Austerity is certainly one. It's not an Aristotelian virtue mentioned in the Ethics, but whether he's walking barefoot or wearing fewer clothing than necessary, wearing fewer clothes than necessary, or controlling himself even in things like laughter and crying, I think it's helpful to see that Phocion is first tough on himself and then only later tough on others, and hard on others because of the virtues that simplicity brings, or austerity brings. And speaking of austerity, he's also simple. He also practices simplicity. And so while the ancient Greeks and Romans would never have considered poverty a virtue, as the later Christians do, right, living like Christ, there is a way that simplicity, that is having enough and knowing your limits, was important going all the way back to Socrates. And those who were his students knew that if they could control their appetites and desires, they were more reliable and incorruptible. And so the foundation, really, of I think almost all of Phocion's virtues and what Plutarch tries to show us is that austerity, okay, being hard on yourself, harder on yourself than you are on others, and simplicity, knowing what you really need and what is just absolutely a waste. Thanks for joining me for another look at a hero's life. And I hope I've inspired you to open Plutarch and let his lives influence yours.